It's the Splendid Table from APM American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Never underestimate American ingenuity. We've saved tomatoes from having too much taste. We've saved fast food from being at all healthy. And now American ingenuity is saving our lunch. No more office bandits, no more school lunch bullies swiping sandwiches. One American has dreamed up the Moldy Sandwich Bag. Printed right on the bag is splotchy green mold. It makes your sandwich look revolting. And then there's the science geek who had his lunch stolen every day at elementary school. His revenge? He teaches us how to build a lunch bag burglar alarm. Stick around. There's more this hour on The Splendid Table.
This week's Splendid Table is a repeat of an earlier broadcast.
This is The Splendid Table from APM American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Here's the thing about chasing after the newest trends. Stick around long enough, and everything that was hot way back when is hot once again. Well, Gilt food columnist Francis Lamb is proving my point. He of the weapons-grade ratatouille recipe we talked about a while ago is now bringing back the French darling of 40 years ago. Francis, hi. Good to have you back.
Hi. Hello. Great to be here.
Well, it's time to share, sir. What is the latest for you? What are you bringing back?
I would hardly credit myself to bringing anything back. But we're talking about Beurre Blanc. And 40 years ago, it was very popular. And it's sort of a hilarious sauce because it was, you know, the intention then was, you know, it was nouvelle cuisine and chefs were revolting against the old escoffier, the very heavy classical French sauces. And what they were thinking was, you know, we want to lighten all of our dishes. We don't want that heavy, goopy sauce. Yeah, we want things that are light. And so, you know, they really popularized Beurre Blanc, which is like 90% pure butter.
Why don't you explain what it is? Because I think a lot of people, you know, don't know about it.
Sure. There's actually a technique, a very common technique in sauce making called mounting with butter. And basically what you do when the sauce is finished, you then take a few cubes of butter and whisk it in at the end. And that gives the sauce a beautiful sheen, a really nice richness, a roundness, obviously the flavor of butter. And it works because the butter then emulsifies into the sauce. It's not this greasy slick that floats on top. And Beurre Blanc is sort of the logical extension of that, where you don't really have a sauce and all you really have is a tiny bit of flavorful liquid that you're just whisking, you know, a fistful of butter into.
And it foams. It's holding that butter at that point where it's creamy but not melted to liquid, right?
Exactly. Exactly. You know, I love butter. I get a little freaked out when you say you get your steamed lobster and there's a little pot of just molten butter. Like, that doesn't taste good to me. That always just tastes greasy. And the technique of emulsification in a Beurre Blanc, what that allows the butter to do is not separate when it melts. It doesn't separate into the fat and into the milk solids. By whisking it, or what some chefs like to do, is just sort of keep tossing the pan until the butter slowly melts and slowly combines with the sauce. You have a really creamy, like you said, really creamy texture, really creamy appearance. I mean, the name Beurre Blanc means white butter. So that really gives you a hint as to what it should look like when you make it.
So walk us through how it's done.
Well, the classical way is you take some wine, maybe a little vinegar, mm-hmm. and some shallots. You make a reduction, which, I mean, literally you're just putting on the stove and cooking it until it mostly disappears.
Yeah.
You take it off the stove so it's not, you know, steaming hot. You let it cool down a little bit, and then you just start throwing in cold butter. And you whisk it in, or like I said, you can just sort of swirl the pan until it combines. And that's basically it. When you've added the right amount of butter so that when you taste it, the flavors of the wine and the acid are in balance with the butter, you have your sauce.
Now, you can use anything, though, in that reduction.
Exactly. Yeah, totally. And that's why I love to play with it, because really, for me, so many of these classical items, these classical dishes, for me, aren't about the dish itself. It's not about the recipe. It's about, oh, what's the technique there and how can you play with it? You know, if I don't have white wine at home, but I have some, you know, nice beer, a nice light beer, why wouldn't I use that? Or if I have red wine, why wouldn't I use that?
Yeah, yeah. And you could throw some chili sauce in there, really, and a little bit of, you know, onion or garlic.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, yeah, I'm sure there's someone out there, a very orthodox person who, you know, lives a charmless and joyless life who's going to scold you for doing that. But, you know, at the end of the day, you cook what tastes good. And the method is really what's fabulous here.
So how do you like to use it?
It really depends on how you're making it, you know, what flavors you're going to use. At sort of most basic form, Beurre Blanc really is a light sauce. I mean, it's ironic, but the flavor of it is light. And so, originally you would use it with maybe a piece of poached fish or steamed fish or poached chicken.
Right.
I love to use it with vegetables. And again, depending on the flavor, one of my favorite things to do in the world right now in the fall is to use apple cider in the reduction.
Ooh, yeah.
And I use apple cider and thyme. You use these really sort of classic, wonderful fall flavors. And I put that with seared scallops, and it's, you know, my favorite thing in the universe, and it takes 5 minutes to make.
Hey, Francis, this is going to be pure gold. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
cooling out with a former lady, got the special sauce. That's why she's my baby. My baby, and of course I'll do anything for her. Anything she wants to show her, honey, show her, girl.
Francis Lam is features editor at Gilt.com. Now, for that butter sauce that quivers between creamy and tangy, check out his recipe for basic Beurre Blanc on the website, splendidtable.org. Now, while you're there, get in on all the free stuff. Download our podcasts, including our newest based on our new book, How to Eat Weekends. Check out our recipe collection, sign up for our e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, and get registered for our monthly book giveaway. This month, it's Jacques Pepin's latest Essential Pepin. You're going to find it all, well, you know where, splendidtable.org. Italian wine I think of as a sleeper. It's called Ripasso, and it doesn't get much play. It's a red that pairs with a lot of dishes, including tricky ones. Well, I've asked Anthony Giglio to come by. Anthony's a wine critic and a writer. Anthony, welcome.
So glad to be here, Lynn.
What do you know about Ripasso?
It's actually quite new to the wine world. It was actually born in the late 20th century, which sounds like a long time ago, but it was only 20 years ago. When producers started to use the leftovers from Amarone. And Amarone, of course, is one of the most unique wines of this region in the Veneto, made with raisinated grapes. They actually cut the red grapes, the Corvina grapes, off the vines late in the harvest, dry them on straw mats until they become raisins. They lose about 50% of their water. And then they're fermented. These very, very high sugar sweet grapes are fermented into an enormous dry red wine. And they're very expensive because of all that labor. What happened in the 80s is they invented this idea of reusing the pomace, the leftover grapes and skins and seeds from Amarone production to make a delicious, lighter style secondary wine that's really called a Ripasso.
And the wine that is the base of all this is called Valpolicella, right?
Right. So basic Valpolicella is a very, very light red, highly acidic, a great food wine, very inexpensive, and for a long time not really well respected. So this is, you know, the frog being turned into the prince.
So they have what? The Valpolicella is in a vat fermenting, and they add those grape skins and seeds from the more expensive Amarone.
Exactly. I love the idea of it feeding the beast. This thing is fermenting and it's running out of things to eat. The fermentation needs more sugar.
Right.
They add it by way of the leftover raisins from Amarone production.
Wow.
And bump it up to a completely different level of quality, of tannin, of depth, and dried fruit flavor that enters the wine.
Do you agree with me? I think Ripasso is a wine that goes with a whole variety of dishes.
Yeah. It straddles the power of Amarone with the very light flexibility of a classic Valpolicella. And that wine, the Valpolicella in general, is often compared to Beaujolais, particularly the lighter styles of Beaujolais Nouveau. But Ripasso itself tends to me to be like the high end of Cru Beaujolais, like a Saint Amour or a Moulin Avant, like the very, very highest end that are almost almost as weighty as red Burgundy. And that's, you know, we know they're the most flexible grapes on the planet.
Yeah. You know, I wonder, did this come about because of economy? Because Valpolicella is a very inexpensive wine, but when you do this to it, it moves up the board a bit. It becomes a finer wine.
I think you're right. And I think that what had happened in the late 60s when the Italians started to classify their wines in the French model using the DOC or the Denominazione d'Origine Controllata, they, in a bit of foolish greed, they expanded the Valpolicella region way beyond its classical zone. They allowed blending grapes into actually mandatory grapes being blended in that weren't supposed to be in there originally, but were now allowed, and there's a lot of politics behind that. They've since been rescinded. But in the early 80s, one winemaker in particular called Massi, the father of Ripasso, came up with this idea. I think it was to try and, you know, add some luster, add a spark to the place, because Valpolicella had really fallen into a category of, you know, it wasn't very highly regarded.
So a couple of names for us to check out if we want to try it.
I mentioned Massi, who makes, you know, and Massi makes a whole range of wines, but they do make a beautiful Ripasso. I also am a big fan of Bertani, which is probably at the higher end of everything that's made in this area. Bola, which everyone knows Bola wines, but Bola is actually one of the pioneers of Amarone and of Ripasso.
Right.
And one more would be Umberto Cesari, who makes a beautiful one called Mara, named for his daughter. They are all around 20 or under.
Anthony, thank you.
Thank you, Lynn.
Anthony Giglio is author of Food & Wine Magazine's 2011 Wine Guide. Now, for his wine picks, check out the website, splendidtable.org. I think you know what I'm thinking, right? We need a dish to match that Valpolicella Ripasso. Wine people always talk about Ripasso with pasta and grilled meats, but this is the wine that can take on flavor blends like orange peel and fennel and garlic, and it's great with pork. And most red wines can't do all that. So here's what I propose. You take a pork butt roast. You season it with sort of a pesto that's made from garlic, orange zest, fennel seeds, rosemary, and some red wine, olive oil, and of course salt and pepper. Just make deep slits in the meat, okay? Stuff the meat with that pesto, rub some on top of it, and then put it in the oven and roast it slow, maybe 325, baste it with the wine, and serve it up. Just open up a bottle of that Valpolicella Ripasso, and you're done. Okay, I've put on the website the recipe for roast pork with orange and rosemary, splendidtable.org. Now, we're going to be back in a moment with the Indiana Jones of ginger and a hidden cuisine of France. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Introduce you to someone. This man is the Indiana Jones of ginger. Dr. John Kress is a research botanist and curator of botany at the Smithsonian Institution. Ginger is his beat, and he's author of the book The Weeping Goldsmith. John, welcome.
It's great to be talking with you.
You know, it occurs to me that the flower we see in the florist shop, we don't make the connection. That's ginger, right?
We see a lot of gingers and a lot of relatives of gingers as flowers, you bet.
And is that where the title or the name Weeping Goldsmith comes from?
It does. I've spent about a decade on and off working on the biodiversity in Myanmar, particularly interested in the gingers that were there, and there's been very few botanists there looking at such things.
Uh-huh.
And I found the very first day I was in that country, in the city of Rangoon, also called Yangon, I saw a bunch of flowers on a basket of a woman going to the market. And I tracked down that flower. It took me 5 years to find out that that species was new to science, had never been described by any botanist before. And here it was on its way to the market in the biggest city in Myanmar. And this plant has particular significance because it serves as an offering in all the Buddhist sanctuaries in Myanmar, whether it's a little temple in your house or whether it's the largest pagoda in Yangon. Everybody brings this plant, and it happens to be called the Weeping Goldsmith. The Burmese name is Badango, which means the Weeping Goldsmith. So for me to find a new ginger, and actually I found quite a few after I got going in Myanmar and Thailand and southern China, was exactly what I was there to do. And it couldn't have been an easier job to find a plant in a basket on a woman's head the very first day I was there.
The ginger that we do buy in the supermarket, does that have a beautiful flower?
It has the ugliest flower of all the gingers. That's why you just eat the root. You don't look at the flowers.
So that's why I can get the root so easily.
Well, maybe. But that ginger, which is called technically Zingibera officinarum, has been grown as a spice for thousands of years.
Uh-huh.
Probably originated in India and is in all the markets there, and now is grown around the world in the tropics as a spice.
Now, I understand that there are leaves of ginger that actually produce dopamine that can be used medicinally. Is that true?
Oh, there's many.
Let
many.
Me count the ways.
Yeah, now, not all of them have actually particular compounds been isolated from them. Very few have received the scientific attention that they probably deserve. But if you go to a market in Myanmar or Thailand, this is a rural market or a country market, you will find hundreds of gingers being sold for spices, for medicinals, for food, for things to make baskets out of, for clothing. I mean, the gingers, we here in North America are just tapping the very tip of the iceberg of what gingers are used for in Asia.
Mm. Now, have you tasted any of these gingers that you've discovered, or is that rather dangerous?
Lynn, that's my job.
So tell all. What do they taste like?
One thing I've discovered is there are no poisonous gingers. There are, so I could not die from any gingers I sampled. Other plants, you can eat them or taste them, and you might have a rough time. And that's happened a few times in my career. But gingers, some of them may taste terrible or are very strong. I shouldn't say any of them taste terrible.
Right.
But none of them will kill you or make you sick. So it's this whole garden of culinary delights, and you can try this or that or this or that and see which ones you like best. And indeed, all kinds of gingers, probably 100 more than we use here in our kind of day-to-day cooking, are used in Southeast Asia and particularly southern China.
You know, I'm thinking of the ginger-like plant, but maybe it isn't at all a ginger, galangale, which is, as I recall, used in Thai cooking and in other, you know, in Southeast Asia. And it's like ginger, but it's not sweet. It's more peppery.
Exactly. And same family. It's in the family Zingiberaceae,
which
is, again, the technical name of the ginger family. And galanga is commonly used mostly in Thailand. I mean, I think it's a big part of Thai food.
Yeah.
A few of the different parts of the plants are used. Actually, the leaves are what you usually see as galanga, but also the flowers, which are really spicy.
Mm.
These are really good. They can be put in salads and things. And even the roots can be cut up like our typical ginger as well. So that plant is used from the very bottom to the very top in cooking in Southeast Asia.
Is the Weeping Goldsmith edible?
You know, that's one of the few gingers that is not that impressive as a spice. It has a slight little tang to it, but the whole group of gingers that are related to the Weeping Goldsmith generally aren't the type that are used in culinary dishes. So it's really just a beautiful and a sacred ginger.
I love the idea of a sacred ginger.
I do too.
John, I'm deeply envious of your day job. And thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Lynn. Thanks a lot.
Research botanist John Press is author of The Weeping Goldsmith.
Okay, a ginger recipe is essential at this moment. You can find Sally Schneider's gingerbread right on the website, splendidtable.org. Intrigued by those hidden cuisines within a cuisine. Now, in her new book, culinary scholar Joan Nathan traces the culinary side of the Jewish diaspora in France. The book is called Quiches, Kugels, and Couscous, My Search for Jewish Cooking in France. Joan, welcome.
Thank you, Lynn. I love to be on your show.
Well, we love having you back. Now, thinking about the fact you have done so much research on Jewish food, what brought you to France, of all places?
Well, I was a student there when I was in my teens and spent my junior year abroad. Had lots of relatives who lived in France. And when I went back on a visit a few years ago, I thought, you know, people are talking about their Jewishness now, and they weren't before. And I thought, this will be a good subject. So I went on a fact-finding trip, and I noticed people that were Jewish that would never even admit it before.
Why did people not want to talk about being Jewish? Is it a holdover from World War II yet?
It's a holdover from life in France through 2,000 years. And life in Europe in many ways. You know, America is a country where people are not afraid to admit who they are totally. In France, although the Jews came there at the time of Julius Caesar and have been everywhere in France throughout the history, even though they've been kicked out of France on many occasions, they've always come back. First of all, it is a rich agricultural country. And people from Italy would come, from Spain, not just Jews. It's been a country of immigration. When you think of the world before the New World was discovered, France was the promised land. And
why? Because of the land, or were there
other
factors?
The land, but also people, they were tolerant of other peoples, and especially a big city like Paris, and more especially after 1789, when it was liberté, égalité, fraternité. It was a country of hope and of accepting peoples. And so not just Jews, everybody came.
Are there recipes today, dishes today in France that are something you can point to and say, this comes from the Jewish heritage of the country?
Well, there are some. A confit of duck. You know, it's different from pork. And Jews were always known as the best producers of foie gras. And the reason that they were interested in foie gras, it was not necessarily for the foie gras, but it was for the fat from having a fat goose that you could use instead of pork fat.
And you know, that's interesting, because I'm just thinking the cured goose breast that served like, you know, ham, paper-thin slice. That's
right.
From a Jewish heritage then, you're
right,
saying.
Right, exactly.
Interesting.
Jews have always taken the dietary laws and adapted them to wherever they lived. And the original Jewish food was like Provençal food, because it was like it came from Palestine or ancient Israel. Then it went to Rome and to Spain and to Provence. And of course, Provence, parts of Provence at that time were parts of Spain. And so you see dishes. I'll give you an example. Fougas, which is a bread that looks like a laddered bread. Well, that was, you know, it's a flat bread. It's sort of like focaccia.
Yeah. And it has holes in it that look like ladders. Yeah,
exactly. And that was the Sabbath bread.
Yeah, but okay, but the name of the book is the other thing. The first word in the name of the book is quiche. So is quiche a Jewish dish?
Well, the Jews have varied quiche. There's an onion quiche in Alsace, which is absolutely delicious, made with butter and lots of onions. That's a Jewish, again, a Jewish adaptation. Flankuchen, they sometimes have with onions and, in a very thin dough. And that would also be a Jewish rendition. And then Kugel, the word Kugel in German. Don't forget, Alsace was Germany and France for so long.
Right.
So
right.
That a word Kugel in Alsatian and in German means circle. And then a Kugel was a round dish that was one other dish for the Sabbath. And the original Kugels come from Alsace and southern Germany, and they went east. Noodle Kugels came later.
Fascinating. Joan, thank you. You've given us the tip of an iceberg. Thank you so much.
Okay, well, thank you.
Joan Nathan's written Quiches, Kugels, and Couscous, My Search for Jewish Cooking in France. And Joan's recipe for the quiche that she talked about, it's called the Onion Tart Lorraine. Well, you can find it on the website, splendidtable.org. To talk eating out with Jane and Michael Stern, the pair that wouldn't be caught dead in any place with a white tablecloth. Jane, Michael, what's happening?
Hi, Lynn. Well, what's happening is that Jane and I just recently invented a pizza.
I beg your pardon. This is
you
historic.
And 4 million other people, but okay.
No. This is really, we invented it.
Well, all right, big deal. Anyone can invent their pizza if they go to the old firehouse in Hollywood, South Carolina, where they have a full assortment of different toppings, and you can create your own. But we were in Hollywood, South Carolina, which is just south of Charleston, looking for regional food, as we're always looking. And
right.
Many years ago, we went to this place with Philip Barden, you know, who's the chef at the old post office on Edisto Island.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And we had a really delicious pizza with local shrimp on it. And that was, you know, the shrimp down there is great. So we thought, well, let's go there again and see if we can do something else that's very local. And among their ingredients are shrimp and locally made sausage, you know, from butchered their hogs. And not among the ingredients, but among the list of appetizers is pimento cheese. So we thought, how would pimento cheese is like just a total obsession in that part of the world. People love it.
Yeah, it's like the cheddar or American cheese with the mayonnaise and the pimento. And
exactly.
Yeah, and it's really more a cheese salad.
It's kind of like a cheese salad, and it can be
pickly,
very bland
pickly.
or
right.
I've had some with olives chopped up in it, or very kind of hot with horseradish. Anyway, their pimento cheese is kind of sharp and cheddary, and kind of it's almost like a coarsely grated cheese. So we thought, aha, how about pimento cheese, some local shrimp, and local sausage on
and
a pizza.
And garlic.
And garlic. So we had them make that up, and when the waitress brought it to us, she said, you know, we never did this pizza before. Do you mind if we try it? So I sent a piece of their pizza back to the kitchen.
The way you would send a glass of wine to your sommelier.
Absolutely.
Exactly right. And they loved it, so they said it's going on the menu as the road food low country special.
All right, I have two questions.
Okay.
First of all, did the pimento cheese complete with the mayonnaise and everything else go on the pizza before it went into the oven?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
And it took the place of mozzarella.
I mean, there was no mozzarella.
Or Parmesan. It was like, you know, a big flat pizza crust. And they put the pimento cheese on and then all the toppings. And then they stuck it in the pizza oven. So it all oozed together.
I have to say, there's something diabolically attractive about this. But here's my second.
It was delicious.
Here is my second question. Are you prepared for the army of pizzaiole?
From the VPN, yes.
From the classical pizza making organization in Naples closing in around your house.
I know.
And you being swept away forevermore for violating tradition.
No, it's definitely not a traditional pizza, but so many of the ingredients that you can get on pizzas at the old firehouse, which, by the way, has a whole menu of other Low Country specials. I mean, you can get your pizza there with fried green tomatoes on top of it. So it's not a pizza place for purists.
It sounds really like it's a heck of a lot of fun.
It is. It is.
And you know what I love there that was not pizza is that part of the country makes the
best crispy flounder.
Oh, yes.
And
oh,
they it's a whole flounder with peach chutney and grits on the side. And it is just delicious.
And you know, Lynn, for Jane to praise a piece of flounder, it means that it's really, really
good. It's the only fish I like. You know, we've had two holidays down there, and I have to say, I still dream of the fried oysters, the flounder, that shrimp.
Oh, yeah.
That's
oh,
like eating sugar.
The best.
But is this really an old firehouse?
Yes, yes. You can look up and see that the doors are permanently...
The bays.
The bay. All right, Jane is the fireman here. Tell us...
The fire marshal.
Right.
Yes. Well, they're not called doors. The things that the apparatus, also known as the fire trucks, go in and out of are the bays, not the doors.
Yes, and so, yes, it is an old firehouse. I mean, obviously, it's now a comfortable restaurant, but you can see a lot of the remnants of when it was an old firehouse.
Hey, guys, thanks.
Bye-bye, Lynn.
Bye, Lynn.
Jane and Michael Stern are the minds behind roadfood.com. Now you can find their latest picks on our website, splendidtable.org. Well, it's time for our weekly trivia challenge. Now the question is, we have locavores and we have vegans. What two new gender-based terms have these two spawned? Okay, you start thinking about it, and we're going to be back with the answer in a moment, and we're going to be talking to you as well. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Well, we're going to talk to you in a minute, so get on the line, 800-537-5252. Friend us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or send us an email. Just go to splendidtable.org. But before I get to the phones, I have got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, we've got locavores, we've got vegans, but what two new gender-based terms have these spawned? Well, there are femivores, and now there are hegans. A femivore is a stay-at-home mom who lives the ideals of the omnivore's dilemma. Writer Peggy Orenstein coined the phrase, and the paraphrase, she calls them chicks with chicks. It's the old back-to-the-land movement, usually without the land, but with canning jars in the kitchen and probably chickens in the garage. Now, the Boston Globe gave us hegans. The hegan is a shot at a silly sex symbol, a middle-aged male vegan who looks like he works out 5 hours a day. But he doesn't keep chickens.
Talk to me. Talk to me.
It's time to turn to your questions, so get on the line, 800-537-5252. You can follow us on Facebook and on Twitter or shoot us an email, splendidtable.org. Victor is on the line from New York City. Victor, what do you want to talk about?
Hello.
Hi.
Well, first of all, I love your show.
Well, thank you. Thank
and
you.
I've been told that I only truly sparkle when I talk about food.
I think we might share that.
I was prompted to call you and tell you about something that I discovered that I think is just unbelievable, and I can't seem to get anybody else on board with me.
What is it? What is it?
Well, my daughter read this novel, a children's novel, a while ago, and she came away from it telling me about sea salt ice cream, and you know, I didn't even really register it at the time, and I thought, yeah, okay, whatever. And then down the line, I happened to be in a high-end grocery store, and this guy was demoing some olive oil that he was making.
Right.
in Sicily, and it's, you know, hand-picked on wooden ladders and, you know, pressed in a stone press. And,
no, it's pressed between the knees of virgins. I know it.
It's all organic.
Yes.
The truth be told, it was an exquisite olive oil, really grassy, fruity, with a peppery aftertaste.
Wow.
And so I bought some. And then later on, even further down the line, I happened to come home with a pint of vanilla, you know, full fat, 114% butter fat.
Right.
Vanilla ice cream. And I'm sitting at my table, and I'm looking at this jar of olive oil, and I said, you know what? I took the olive oil, and I put a little thin trickle over the top of the ice cream.
Whoa.
And I happened to have rather coarse sea salt on the table, too, and I just took a few grains of that, a pinch of that, and I put that on top of it, and I looked at it for a minute, and I said, let's try it.
How was it?
It was exquisite. I mean, it was sumptuous, I think, is a good word for it. The texture of the olive oil just seemed to, like, intensify the buttery smoothness of the ice cream.
And did the olive oil get, because it's against something cold, did the consistency change? I was just wondering, does it become more syrupy a bit? You know,
a little bit. Yeah. A little bit. But it had a tendency to kind of sort of slide off, you know. So after the first half a minute or so, I had to dip down to the bottom and get a little olive oil on the spoon. And then that was a little bit of a crunch that the sea salt gave it. So texturally, it was really interesting. So
I'm rolling it around on the palate of my imagination.
Yeah.
It's,
oh, you have to try it.
You need a really flavorful olive oil. But wow,
and
this sounds incredible.
Right. So I start talking to other people about it. You know, hey, I tried this and it was really good. And they just look at me like I'm crazy. You know, like olive oil and ice cream. Are you insane?
I'm sorry. You put those same people in the seat of a restaurant in New York, like Jean-Georges or Danielle Bleu or, you know, whoever, right?
Exactly.
And you put a $15 price tag on that scoop of ice cream with that oil and that salt, and they're going to come back and they're going to say, do you know what I tasted?
They're going to rave about it.
Exactly.
Yep.
Do not allow anyone to deter you from your pleasure in this. And keep experimenting. This sounds so good. I can't wait. I'm going to try it.
Really good.
Oh, thank you, sir.
Yeah.
Bye.
All right. So long.
Wow. That's all I keep saying. But boy, that sounds wonderful. That sounds just fabulous. By the way, there's olive oil ice cream, gelato, and it's wonderful. And it has a salty undertone, which is just fabulous. So why not? Anyway. Call us, 800-537-5252. We've got Ashton calling from Minneapolis. Ashton, what do you want to talk about? Hi.
I wanted to ask you about a thing called bread soup.
Oh, yeah.
I was in Iceland for about 6 weeks earlier this summer, and while I was there, I spent part of my time kind of volunteering on an organic farm.
Right.
And it was a dairy farm, so we got to, you know, make, like, a lot of cheese and yogurt and, you know, really, like, beautiful homemade bread every day. But one day after putting in a full 8 hours of work, I came into the farmhouse for dinner, and the only thing they had to eat was bread soup, which was, as far as I could tell, just a big loaf of rye bread boiled in some water until it got this disgusting consistency with some salt and sugar and whole lemon slices in it.
So your question is, what is it with bread soup?
Yeah, I want to know, like, I guess I wanted to challenge you to, like, tell me how bread soup could ever be something delicious, because it was just awful.
It was terrible.
I mean, it was a cultural experience, and I ate it and I didn't complain or anything, but it was just, you know, it kind of blew my mind, I guess.
Too much culture in one bowl.
Yeah.
What you had is sort of a tradition in a lot of parts of the northern part of the world, you know, and it's done in different ways. But the reality is that it always comes out, of course, of not wasting a bit of bread. And when you get down into the Mediterranean, bread soups get pretty exciting. So, for instance, you might make a vegetable soup, right? where you take a mess of vegetables. You might saute some of the onion and the carrot and the celery to get even more flavor. You throw in a lot of herbs. You cook those vegetables. And then you could take a really delicious whole grain bread. You know, one of those things that's really tough and chewy. The bread has to be great to start with. And you would toast that. And you could toast that right over the burner, you know, on top of the stove. Rub it with garlic. Put it in the bottom of a soup bowl. Pour a little olive oil over that. And then spoon the soup over it.
Okay.
Now that becomes a really, this is peasant food. This is people stretching, you know, everything that they've got to make good eating. And you can do that in all kinds of ways. Like you could take a Scandinavian potato leek soup, right, with maybe carrots in it. And then you could take something like, you probably had it in Iceland, those grainy rye breads, and they're really dense. You would lightly toast that bread, and you would put melted butter on it, and maybe even a little bit of sugar and salt. And then you put that potato leek carrot soup in there, and you get a really nice taste. I'd love to convert you to being a lover of bread soups.
I can understand the, you know, the tradition of where it comes from. It was just, I was pretty displeased to have that as my only option.
I can imagine, working all day. Hey, thank you. Try the bread soup with the vegetables and the whole deal.
Yeah, I'll give it a second chance. Thanks.
Thank you for calling. Take care.
Yeah, you too. Bye.
Bye. 6 weeks in Iceland. That would give you a great chance to really explore. I understand there are steamed whole grain breads there that use the natural steam that comes out of the earth. You know, there are steam baths and that kind of thing all over the place. And that steaming process brings out a flavor in the rye that you just can't get any other way. All right, enough already. You can call 800-537-5252 or go to Facebook. We've got Chris calling from Rutland, Vermont. Chris, what's up?
My wife's birthday is coming up, and I'm totally spoiled. She makes bread once or twice a week, and it is absolutely fabulous. And I'm wondering if there's any utensils or things that I could get her for a gift.
You mean for bread making?
Yes. She makes it by hand. She's got a big bread board that my brother-in-law made 20 years ago for her, and she has her own sourdough, starter that she set up 10 years ago, and so she loves it, and I love it, and I'm just wondering if you have any ideas for it.
Oh, boy. This sounds so good. Okay. Wonderful. Does she use a baking stone by any chance?
No,
she
does.
Does she let the bread rise on a pan?
She puts it in a bowl and rises it once, and then she puts it in the pan and lets it rise again.
And she's making like a loaf. It looks like a sandwich bread.
And a lot of times she'll take half of it and make it into rolls.
Is she someone who likes to try something a little bit different on occasion?
Every recipe is different. And I say how wonderful the bread is. She says, well, enjoy it. You'll never get that exactly again.
Okay, a couple of things come to mind, all right? There is a basket that is lined with fabric, okay, that you flour and you do the last rise of the bread, not in the pan but in the basket. And then the basket is, the bread in that basket, the risen bread, is turned over onto a baking sheet or right onto tiles or a baking stone you might have in the bottom of the oven. And then another thing to consider, and again, this is if she does free-form loaves as opposed to things in a pan, is to get her a baker's peel. And this is a metal or a wooden long-handled, it looks almost like a flat shovel. And the idea is that when you're baking your bread on stones or even on a large baking sheet in the oven, you can slip this underneath it to lift the bread out. Bakers use it in wood-fired ovens, you know, where they're baking right on the bottom of the oven.
Right.
If she does she slash her loaves? Does she make cuts in the
sometimes.
Top?
Okay. Yeah, sometimes.
There is a special razor that bakers use in France to make those slashes. The razor is very sharp, and it's a very professional little deal to have.
Yeah, I tried cutting one time, and she stopped me because it wasn't looking right. And I guess you're right. There must be a special knife for that.
I think she would really enjoy it. And, you know, one last thing is there's a book that came out quite a long time ago But I think it's out there, you know, second, third hand. And it's by Bernard Clayton, and it's called The Breads of France. And it was one of the first books to discuss and attempt to duplicate some of the techniques from the great bread bakeries of France.
Wow.
You're off and running.
I just wanted to know that I love her and her cooking and just appreciate her.
You're really a dear. You know that, Chris? She's lucky.
Well, I'm lucky. I'm the one who's totally spoiled with fresh bread. We haven't had store-bought bread in probably a decade, so...
That's pretty swell, Chris. Hey, you wish her a happy birthday from all of us, okay?
I will. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Take care.
Bye.
Call us 800-537-5252. Something unexpected happened recently in London. 52 nations put up their best espresso people at the World Barista Championships, and an American walked away with the crown. He's Michael Phillips. He's Director of Education at Intelligentsia Coffee, and he's on the line. Michael, welcome.
Hey, Lynn. Thanks for having me.
So, Michael, congratulations. The world's best barista? Are you the first American to ever get this award?
I actually am the first American to ever get this award. It's kind of crazy.
But I can imagine the Italians were probably pretty stunned, weren't they?
That's what a lot of people would imagine, but actually the Italians are they're not necessarily the people that have beaten this game nowadays.
Really? Who do you want to beat these days?
Well, I mean, most people that do well are usually just trying to beat themselves, but as far as prominent players in the game, London has surprisingly done very well for the last two or three years, and before then there was a healthy swath of Nordic competitors that were very good.
That's so interesting. What do you have to do? What is that competition about?
The most important thing is to really understand your coffee. But as far as the technical side of it, you're presenting three rounds of drinks to a panel of judges, four sensory judges and two technical judges.
Mm-hmm.
It's a round of espresso, a round of cappuccino, and a round of signature beverage. And you're trying to serve them these coffees and have them enjoy the most impeccably well-made drinks that you can, while conveying a lot of the information and knowledge that really rounds out a good culinary experience.
So are you actually talking to them as you're doing the presentation, or is it a case that they will know from tasting your coffee that you know?
No, it's everything. I mean, they're grading the presentation of the coffee, the flavor, the appearance, your knowledge, your professionalism, how well you manage yourself on the bar. It's really all aspects are being taken into account.
So what makes the finest cup of espresso?
Well, I mean, that's like what makes the finest glass of wine. People are going to like different things, and there are certainly different qualities. In my mind, one of the things that I really look for is a really nice, balanced cup that has some sort of a signature element that you can latch onto that gives it character, like a pronounced acidity or a very nice body or, you know, some feature to make it a bit more remarkable than just your average espresso.
Mm-hmm. And you're talking about the taste, but I understand there has to be that foam on top, that crema?
Yeah, the crema. I mean, crema is certainly an aspect of espresso. It's one that possibly gets a little more attention than it deserves. One of the main reasons people, I believe, historically have really enjoyed having crema on their espressos, it's a sign that the shot was pulled properly and that the coffee's fresh. Like if you're using coffee that's very old and stale or coffee that wasn't extracted in the right fashion, then it won't have the crema on it. But even in a really nice, fresh, well-prepared shot, one of the first things I do when I get a shot that I'm about to drink is I stir that crema in because you want the shot itself to be mixed up and really well incorporated.
Uh-huh. Well, congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Michael, thank you.
My pleasure.
Michael Phillips of Intelligentsia Coffee is the 2010 winner of the World Barista Championships. Well, thanks for joining us. And remember, you can contact us anytime. You have a great weekend. Let me leave you with this thought from Ronald Reagan, who said, "I never drink coffee at lunch. I find it keeps me awake for the afternoon." The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media. You're going to find information on nearly everything you heard here today on our website, splendidtable.org.
Check out our series of special podcasts called How to Eat Weekends, based on our new book of the same name, as well as our new blog. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Jennifer Larson and Mary Beth Leone Geffen. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Sarah Lear. Our managing producer is Sally Swift. We'll be back next week. You have a great one, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
American Public Media.